Welcome to Media and Culture, a podcast created for AEJMC's Cultural and Critical Studies Division. I'm Perry Parks, the division head for 2021-22, and I'm pleased to introduce this series that highlights timely and important research exploring cultural and critical topics in media studies.
My name is Ruth DeFoster. I am a lecturer and the director of undergraduate studies at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication. I was head of the Cultural and Critical Studies Division last year from 2020 to 2021. And joining me today is Sarah Chabon, an assistant professor at Seattle Pacific University. Dr. Chabon is a critical cultural scholar focused on the intersections between media, women's social movements, and geopolitics in the Middle East. She's the author of the new book, Iranian Feminism and Transnational Ethics in Media Discourse, which just came out this year, just in the last month. She's also the digital editor of the Cultural and Critical Studies Division. So Dr. Chabon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, I'd like to ask the question that I ask all of our guests first, and that is, how did you get started on your research program? What inspired you to study these interconnections between women, social movements, and the politics of activism and oppression?
So I really like this question, but I always find it somewhat difficult to answer because to me, it seemed natural to do it. It's a reflection of my own identity in a lot of ways. So before I was an academic, I was a journalist and I spent a lot of time in the Middle East, specifically Israel and the West Bank, and half my family is from the Middle East. And I've visited refugee camps, different media outlets, met with dignitaries, but I've always been interested in social justice issues, particularly as they pertain to women and the Middle East. Again, I'm half Middle Eastern and I'm a woman, so I have some stake in the game here. And so as a former journalist, I'm always interested in current events, which can be difficult when it comes to research because things change so quickly. But when I started my master's program in 2014, there was just a ton of news surrounding ISIS recruitment techniques on social media to recruit teenagers specifically from Western countries. And I was intrigued by how news media told these stories. The men in the stories were framed completely differently from the women, as if women recruited to ISIS were only there so they could find a husband, which is honestly ridiculous because that's like saying that the only reason girls go to college is to like get their MRS degrees. So I found that really intriguing. And so if I find it interesting, I'm just gonna follow it and see what happens.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's actually a good segue to my next question, because what I wanted to do was to rewind a little bit and to talk about a paper you wrote while you were still in graduate school. And this is a paper I had the pleasure of watching you present at AEJMC all the way back in 2018, before the pandemic. And this work, I remember it immediately piqued my interest. I came up to talk to you afterward because my own area of research overlaps quite a bit with yours, the media coverage of terrorism and gun violence. And that paper, which you later published in the International Journal of Communication, was titled Teenagers, Terrorism, and Technopanic: How British Newspapers Framed Female ISIS Recruits as Victims of Social Media. And in this paper, you examined newspaper coverage of this really interesting high-profile incident in the UK. So you looked at this case during the height of ISIS's influence in 2015, in which these three girls from London were recruited as brides for ISIS jihadis. And in particular, you focus on this outsized role of social media in this story, which you argue became a moral panic. So can you talk a little bit about what you believe caused this incident to be so widely covered in the UK? Why is this an interesting case study?
So it's a sexy subject, right? Like, you're talking about women, terrorism, and technology. These are three really hot topics within news media and just media in general. And one of the young women at the time, Shamima Begum, she was the poster girl for the ISIS campaign at this time. And so she had ended up leaving the UK when she was 15, along with two other girls. And honestly, this is just a perfect landscape for the white savior narrative as well. And I think that that's another thing that people get really interested in. I mean, you literally have the Metropolitan Police in the UK following the girls to rescue them from being recruited to ISIS. And it fits perfectly with this trope of white men saving brown women from brown men. So you know, research already backs up that this is what people like to read about. So I think that that's one of the huge reasons why it became so popular, because it was happening in real time and you were essentially watching like this race against time. In fact, I think that was one of the headlines of the articles that I looked at. It's a race against time before the girls cross into Turkey and make it into Syria to meet their potential husbands. And I thought that this was fascinating, obviously, for one, just because of the gender aspect of it, but also because of the Orientalist aspect of it too. So this paper came out in 2020, and I believe it was in about 2019, Shamima Begum was trying to come back to the US from Syria. And she was, the UK tribunal in February 2020 decided to remove her citizenship. Because she wasn't, in their eyes, she wasn't a British citizen anymore because she left the UK. And so it reintroduces this question of who does and doesn't constitute a real British citizen. And I've chatted with some of my own British Pakistani journalist friends who about this particular subject as well. So she was born in the UK, but her parents were of Bangladeshi descent. So the UK tribunal ruled that because she was a citizen of Bangladesh by descent, this wouldn't make her stateless because that's illegal. But she was born in the UK. She's never been to Bangladesh. The Bangladeshis did not want her. They're like, you know, this is your mistake. And they did. And so the UK didn't want to claim her. So I think that that was very fascinating to me as well. And the way this works in the US is if you're born, then that's your right. You can't have your citizenship removed. But if you're a naturalized citizen, you can have your citizenship revoked for certain reasons, like joining a terrorist group. Australia, you can have your citizenship removed based on national security concerns if you have dual citizenship within another country. So that was one thing that really intrigued me. But as for the social media aspect of the story, I was so intrigued by this brilliant PR campaign that ISIS had initiated. I was in a marketing job at the time, and just watching some of the same techniques play out from a terrorist network seemed so bizarre to me at the time. And the way we were looking at potential marketing plans for organizations, you could literally apply these same case study techniques to what was happening with ISIS on social media. So all of that conflated together makes for some really interesting work.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, it reminds me a little bit of the Pulse nightclub shooting here in the US, which was perpetrated by an Afghan American citizen. So he was an American citizen. He was born and raised in the US. He had never been into Afghanistan, but I did a little work on that, on the media coverage of that. And he was 100% of the time he was framed as an outsider to the US.
Yes.
His Afghan identity was front and center. And in fact, he was not Afghan. He was American. He was not naturalized. He was born in the US. And so that seems like that's echoed very strongly in this case, where there's this question of like otherness and who gets to count as an American or a British citizen. And, you know, folks who are brown, or especially folks who are Muslim, are innately sort of placed in that other category sort of by default.
Exactly. And I mean, what's interesting too about this case with these three girls is they were framed as victims, right? Up until they actually crossed over and like the Metropolitan Police didn't make it. They didn't get them in time. And so after they literally just right crossed that line, that is when they became perpetrators. And I think that's interesting too, is the news coverage completely changed after that point.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I especially want to follow up on something you mentioned a minute ago, which is the fact that ISIS and actually Al-Qaeda as well, a lot of these big terrorism organizations, they have really sophisticated marketing departments. They write newsletters, they issue press releases. Like there is this intentional marketing approach that they take, which really surprises my students sometimes. But in this paper, you talk a lot about the sort of technological fetishism, specifically of social media in this case. Can you expand on that? What do you mean by technological fetishism?
So I love this term. And when I introduce it to my students, I think they are like, wow, I hadn't really thought about that. Technological fetishism is rooted in Marx's concept of commodity fetishism. So it's giving an object autonomy and power that it doesn't actually have. This is exactly what we do with technology all the time. We treat technology like it has the ability to solve social problems, to keep the economy vibrant, to provide us with a better life. So in essence, because we treat technology as if it has power, it inevitably becomes powerful. And so in this particular case, the way that the UK was framing the recruitment of these three teenage girls, they weren't just framing them as victims of ISIS, but as victims of social media. And in the paper, I argue that this is a moral panic, or what can be called a techno panic, which is basically whenever a new technology is introduced into a society, it can be considered a threat to society's overarching morals or values or powerful players in society. And it's usually framed as a danger to women and children, but particularly children. And it always ends up appealing to parents because parents are going to be the first people to advocate for regulation. So at this time, 2014, 2015, the UK was blaming social media companies for allowing ISIS to be on these platforms, A, but B, there's this lack of regulation. So there were a lot of calls for wanting to regulate social media technology in the UK as well. And so this was a really ideal case study to launch that particular campaign forward.
Yeah, and that's something with a long history, right? I mean, the sort of moral panic framing specifically around new technologies. One of my former colleagues, Shayla Thiel Stern, wrote a book about this, about specifically girls and on Facebook and Instagram, and the way that that's presented as like the technology itself is a threat to our women and our children. And even going as far back to, you know, the introduction of the telephone, there's all of this contemporary writing at the time about this worry that men can now invade your female children's space, your teenage girls' space at home, and that this will represent like a sexual crisis for women and for girls. And so it's interesting to see that continually repackaged and replicated, even in the social media era, and especially in 2015, because that was a really interesting moment where social media was just starting to realize, they were just starting to realize their potential in terms of large-scale data mining and hyper-niche personalization. It was just the very beginning of that conversation, and it certainly has remained relevant ever since. And one last thing I wanted to ask about this case study has to do with this intersection between gender and terror. I think that's really interesting too. So how did this case produce different themes than coverage of male ISIS recruits, for example?
The gender aspect is one of the most interesting elements of the case, because I feel like the study showcased feminism in a really interesting and dark way. Because, you know, you were just talking about how women and young women especially are sexualized a lot of the time, especially when it's relating to technology. And so it was easier to create these narratives of jihadi brides as sex slaves, because it's easy to use this narrative of sexualizing jihadi brides, because it's already in line with these Orientalist themes that play into the West is best narrative, right? And the biggest difference that I saw between coverage of male jihadis and female jihadis is the victim versus threat frames. Because again, you don't want to believe that the brown women that you were saving from the brown men would return to the brown men. So it was easier to say that they were brainwashed and that they were groomed, instead of entertaining these ideas that women could also have a thirst for violence, because it doesn't align with our Western ideology of femininity. Unless we're talking about a woman scorned, like in Fatal Attraction, then we understand that, but that's also a very sexualized kind of violence. So Western countries need to be careful, because this doesn't align with the West is best narrative if young women are fleeing the land of the free to be the sex slaves of jihadis. But there's plenty of research backing this up, that you're either painting the woman as either hyper feminine or the complete antithesis of femininity, meaning hyper-feminine in the way that, again, with that woman scorned idea, or complete anti-femininity in that a woman is just trying to be a man. So something that would be able to fit within our our Western understanding of what it means to be a woman. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, definitely. It definitely does. And I'm glad you raised the Orientalist perspective here too, because I mean, especially going back to like Saeed's original book, he talks a lot about the way that the Middle East is framed in the West as this sort of like supine feminized part of the world that's eager to be taken, that's eager to be subsumed or oppressed. And I definitely think we're seeing that here as well. And not just in the UK, but also in the US. Like there've only been a handful of cases in the US where there's been a female, you know, perpetrator of terror or female ISIS recruit. The San Bernardino couple springs to mind, for example. And it is interesting how I saw this too in coverage of that case, where there were two schools of thought in terms of how the female half of that couple was framed. And it was either she's an evil monster or she is an innocent victim. And there was nothing in between. It really was not particularly nuanced. And it sounds like that's what kind of happened here as well.
And the way that this study originally started, I had started this study as a dissertation, and I did a comparative look at recruits from the US, the UK, and Australia, which honestly would have had to have just been a book because it was just so much data. And the UK case stood out the most, but in each one of those cases, they sexualized the women. Like they were doing it for love every single time was the overarching theme with that, which I thought was really interesting.
It is interesting. It kind of removes their agency. Like they couldn't possibly have chosen this for themselves. They were tricked into it. So that's another good segue, because I wanted to move into talking about the next paper that I saw you present at AAJMC, which is the following year in 2019. And this paper actually won the James Carey Memorial Award for top student paper in the Cultural and Critical Studies Division. And it was titled White Wednesdays, Femo-Nationalism and Authenticity, a Twitter Discourse Analysis on the Role of the Hijab in Feminist Activism. And some of this data and work went into the publication of your brand new book, which I mentioned at the outset, Iranian Feminism and Transnational Ethics and Media Discourse, which is what I'd like to talk about now. And so first, can you just kind of walk us through the inspiration and the impetus for this book? What drove you to write this book now in 2022?
So again, I'm driven by current events. And in 2017, there were protests that erupted in Iran at the time. And what was also going on simultaneously with this other social movement that didn't really have anything to do with the protests that were happening in 2017, but they got conflated together. And what happened here was there was a woman, Bida Mubahid, and she was standing in downtown Tehran with a hijab tied to the end of a stick. And what she was doing was she was protesting against the compulsory hijab law in Iran. And she stood there for about an hour. And after an hour, you know, she was arrested, but an hour was long enough for her image to go viral. And this is where the White Wednesdays campaign came onto the global scene. White Wednesdays was originally started by a woman named Masi Elenejad, and she was an Iranian journalist. She's now in the US. She was exiled from Iran. And she started working with the Trump administration to improve women's rights in Iran, which is really an interesting collaboration. Mm-hmm. So our current geopolitical relationship with Iran is not exactly on great terms, if you've seen the news in any capacity. And so watching the Trump administration work with Masi Elenejad gave these native informant vibes. So a native informant is somebody who willingly perpetuates these colonial or Islamophobic discourses by using their own personal stories as these archetypes or representations of their problematic traditions or cultures. We've seen that with Azar Nafisi in Reading Lolita in Tehran, Ayan Hirsi Ali. It's very similar to Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom or Malcolm X's House Negro. So within certain circles, but especially within Iran, Masi Elenejad is considered to be a native informant because she did start this movement to protest against compulsory hijab law in Iran. But when she came into the US, she started this very interesting relationship with the Trump administration, particularly with then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And so she used this narrative of what was going on with women in Iran to help create this narrative that would further isolate Iran, which is what the US wanted to do, and to also justify the US's decision to pull out of the nuclear deal with Iran back in 2018. So she ended up working for Voice of America, and she was paid $230,000 from the U.S. State Department for her commentary on anti-compulsory hijab in Iran. And the Trump administration was very invested in regime change. And for people who know anything about Iranian history, this is not the first time that the U.S. has wanted to intervene in Iranian affairs. I mean, if anybody remembers the coup in the 1950s. So again, this is what was happening when I was doing my dissertation. So I was very much motivated just by what was happening at the time.
Wow, that is really interesting. I did not know about the Voice of America gig. So one of the challenges you discuss in this book has to do specifically with globalization and political economy. And political economy is one of these areas that I get really excited about as a cultural studies scholar. It's kind of hard to get students excited about it, but these are really, really important topics to think about, like production and ownership and how those affect the products that we get. I mean, this landscape where we have basically five media companies that produce everything we consume. So specifically, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how resource depletion and shrinking newsroom budgets can affect really important international news coverage, especially coverage of Muslim women.
So the thing about this book is that it's not really a book about Iran as much as it is about journalism and the way that we talk about foreign affairs. And Iran is really just a case study to have this larger conversation. And the reason native informants work so well within the US especially is because they're easy to access. They're right in your backyard. They're there and they're willing and they're ready. And working within news, especially in this day and age, it's really hard to get your sources on the record. It's hard to find people, especially with the time constraints, with the 24/7 news network constantly having to churn out new information. This is going to inevitably have an impact on the quality of international news coverage. And we've seen more and more international news bureaus closing down. We don't have those bureaus anymore. And we have more parachute journalists. So people literally coming into a foreign country and reporting on a situation that they really don't have that much context about and then leaving. And when it comes to covering Muslim women, we're seeing this with Afghanistan right now. And I'm working on a project about this right now too. We're relying on the diaspora. We're relying on people who, again, are literally in our backyard. And this has a lot to do with not being able to have the resources to collaborate with people on the ground anymore. We don't have our journalists embedded in the community anymore. We don't have the people that we would normally go to, what some people would call fixers. And so by not having those resources anymore, we're forced to rely on whatever sources are available to us in those cases. Now, in the book, I would argue against that in terms of like what social media can offer us.
Yeah, it's interesting. Social media might be an avenue to try to mitigate some of those problems, right? And certainly, I mean, this is a widespread problem. I mean, shrinking newsroom budgets mean that you don't have the money to do this really in-depth investigative work because you got to pay someone for maybe 6 months to a year for something that may turn out to be nothing. And so there really are just this handful of news organizations that can still afford to do that kind of work. But the rest, it's interesting to hear, the rest are just kind of relying on native informants and the parachuting in, which you lose a lot of that context.
Even with freelance journalists, so you see more freelance bureaus popping up, and that's a great avenue for local journalists, but it's also more of a business. It's not as much about the real purpose of journalism. It's more about making money. And so you find somebody in a country who lives there who can write a story, and it's basically selling the story to the highest bidder. And we see that some of the top news organizations in the world, particularly coming from the Western world and China, are the ones that are paying for those stories.
And then that becomes very transactional. is what you're saying, right? And you sort of lose the ethos of journalism. That's one of the solutions that you call for in the book is a transnational feminist framework in news coverage of women's issues worldwide. What might that look like?
So just to be clear, transnational feminism is this practice of working towards women's rights within these shifting cultural, political, and geographical contexts. And it rejects a single definition of feminism, as well as any classic Western interpretations of feminism. And it argues against any one single woman's experience, and instead recognizes inequalities across different groups of women. So let's take the hijab, for example, right? So the connotation that comes with hijab differs depending on certain cultural, political, and geographical contexts. So for instance, there was a time before 1979 when the hijab was prohibited in Iran because the Shah believed the hijab contradicted the country's rise to modernity. And this is very similar to the ideology that France holds today. There are several mandates that ban wearing hijab in France because it interferes with the country's secular culture, and immigrants are expected to assimilate to that culture. But then you have the US, where notable activists like Linda Sarsour or Ilhan Omar are working to normalize the hijab. And some companies are treating the covering as a commodity, like Macy's luxury hijab line or Nike's athletic hijabs. But those contexts aren't very apparent in Western news coverage. Western news coverage, particularly US news coverage, creates this binary when it comes to hijab. You're either for it or you're against it. And it's not really about choice. It's about Orientalism. And there's this us versus them framework. An example that comes to mind is that CNN produced a segment that featured Linda Sarsour, who started wearing hijab when she was 19. She's the only woman in her family to wear hijab. And she's very well known for her commentary and saying that hijab is very empowering to her. So you have Linda, and then you have Mahsi Alinejad, the leader of the White Wednesdays movement, and who's very much anti-hijab, and she's the only woman in her family who doesn't wear it. And a producer decided to put those two women on television together to basically argue over whose social movement was more important and more worthy of support. And
oh, I hate that.
But it got views. People love that stuff. People love that stuff. And so the whole point of journalism is to provide a framework for people to understand the world, right? And so if you continuously create this binary about hijab, that's all you're going to see. You don't see any nuance there at all, and how the context can change depending on what's going on. And so essentially, what I would love to see within news media is seeing that same transnational framework be applied on all issues, not even just on women. Plenty of US scholars have talked about this and critiqued this. Stephen Ward obviously comes to mind, that you cannot have a globalized framework for media ethics. You just can't, because you're not going to all agree on what ethics should be or how ethics can change depending on your context. And most of the people who do work on media ethics are Western scholars. And so it's inevitably going to be biased. So transnationalism is a different way to look at how we can cover other countries, especially in an ethical way.
Yeah, it strikes me that piece from CNN, I mean, activism, social issues, social movements, it's not a zero-sum game. And so the idea of sort of presenting, you know, now them as two competing pundits who have to then shout over each other, that to me, that sort of represents the very worst that broadcast media have to offer. So I'm disheartened to hear that, but I can't say I'm particularly surprised. We're running out of time, so I'd love to ask you, this is a really important question. I think this is probably the most important question I'm going to ask. What recommendations do you have for journalists based on your research? So what should journalists who read your book, what should they take out of this? How can Western journalists avoid some of these very well-documented pitfalls you talk about in the book, this over-reliance on official sources, vending out international reporting to freelancers, parachuting in, Islamophobia, this technological fetishism in their work?
I truly believe that social media is underutilized. I think part of this is because journalists, particularly Western journalists, think of social media within a Western context and don't really consider how social media is utilized in the Middle East. The way that we use Twitter in the United States is completely different than how Saudi Arabia uses Twitter. It's just different. There are 8 out of 10 users in Saudi Arabia are on Twitter. Whereas I think that the US might be half of that, probably even less because of recent events. So I think, you know, we have seen journalists use social media when crowdsourcing information during the Arab Spring. NPR's Andy Carvin did an amazing job of crowdsourcing information with activists and finding ways to validate that information with the sources that he used. Because in the same way that you would use a fixer back when we had more international bureaus, you find sources that you can trust and continuously go to those sources and work with those sources who are on the ground when you can't be. So we saw it with the Arab Spring. We saw it with the 2016 bombings in Brussels. We see it when we have natural disasters. So I think working with activists and local journalists like international bureaus used to do would really change the game instead of, again, and it takes more work, but I don't think it takes as many resources necessarily to make that happen, but it can take more time. And what I don't understand is why you would report on a women's movement in Iran using one Iranian woman when you could go onto Twitter and see the conflicting narratives surrounding hijab and the movement right there on Twitter. You can see it. All you have to do is enter in the hashtag for the movement and you can plainly see that. And I think it's the same thing as being on the ground and interviewing people on the ground. And so I think that there just needs to be a different way of using social media instead of continuously using the same official sources over and over again. I think that that could really improve our coverage in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I could certainly inject some very much needed nuance instead of presenting these issues as black and white or binary. So finally, what are you working on now? What kind of future directions do you think your work might take you in?
So like I said, I'm very driven by current events. So I'm about to present a paper with one of my colleagues on a Twitter movement surrounding women in Afghanistan, but it's primarily spearheaded by the Afghan diaspora. So the women, Afghan women on the ground, their voices are relatively invisible. And so there's these very problematic representations coming from diasporic activism. So I'm really interested in kind of comparing those discourses on social media versus what Afghan women on the ground have to say.
Cool. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Shaban. Thank you for making the time to meet with me and to talk about your work.
It was fun. Thank you.
You have been listening to Media and Culture, a podcast created for AEJMC's Cultural and Critical Studies Division. I'm Perry Parks, the division head for 2021-22. Please look for future editions in this series and check us out on social media.